This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Stephen Ho. I am a comedian and social media digital creator in Los Angeles.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thanks for coming on, Stephen. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
This might be off, but I just saw a TikTok right before I got in here of a girl was like, yo, if I say I want to go eat Vietnamese food, I'm not talking about eating fucking pho, okay? I'm talking about bánh cọc, bánh xèo, bún bò huế. And, you know, she named like 30 other things. She's like, don't come at me with Vietnamese and like say you want to eat Vietnamese and go pho. Then, you know, I think that was like, wow, that was so real. Like, yeah, you want Vietnamese food. We're not talking about like pho. We're talking about like cơm tấm bì chả sườn nướng and shit. You know, we're not talking about your regular bowls of pho. She was like, that's like the hamburgers of Vietnamese food. Once in a while, it's okay, but we're not trying to get that. You're talking real Vietnamese food.
Yeah, it's boring, right? Like we are known right now, and I'm thankful for this, that we're known for pho, but me, but that's probably like 2% of our menu.
Yeah, it really is. And don't get me wrong, like my parents owned pho restaurants. Like we had two when I was growing up and I loved it. But like that was one thing that was on the menu. You know, we had cơm gia đình, we had like all the other like bún riêu, you know, we had all the other soups too.
Yeah. Which restaurants did they own?
My parents owned restaurants up in the Bay Area. So I grew up in San Jose. Their first restaurant was called King Vietnamese Restaurant. And the second one had my dad's name in it called Pho Hai in Milpitas.
And did you work on the line with them?
Oh, yeah. I wasn't in the kitchen. I mean, I was too young. I think when the first restaurant opened up, I wasn't working for the first restaurant. I was in like first, second grade. But the second restaurant, I was in high school. And yeah, I mean, I did the busing. I took orders sometimes. My Vietnamese wasn't great. I remember just getting in trouble a lot because I was young. I was a young waiter, and like, you know, the guys who were coming in were like these old Vietnamese dudes who just didn't have time for like my bullshit. One old man asked for mộc chén gừng sắc, right? Like ginger, and I was like, oh, I don't think we have that. And he got so mad at me. Like he was like, go get somebody who knows what they're talking about. What do you mean you don't have it? And my dad had to come out and be like, I'm so sorry. He's young. He doesn't know.
And did they get the ginger for him?
Yeah, yeah. They just, you know, they shredded up the ginger and gave it to him. Because of course they had it. I'm like, I've never heard of that before. I don't think that's on the menu.
Well, first off, congratulations on your enormous body of work. It's everywhere. And, you know, before I went to see you at Embarrassed by Night, I saw you on the TikToks and the IG, and it's just an enormous amount, and it's great content.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, it's been a wild ride. It's been 2 years of the content creating now.
Holy shit! It's only been 2 years.
Yeah. Started, you know, end of 2019, beginning of 2020.
So, can you walk me through sort of like your childhood? Did you grow up wanting to do comedy? Did you know that that was in your bones at some point?
I didn't know. You know what? I felt like I always knew it was there. I didn't know that's what I was wanting. I didn't know it was what I wanted to do because I didn't realize like it existed. Because I remember growing up watching a lot of the skits on Paris by Night. You know, these skits were like, these guys were like dressed up as women and like they would do like funny sketch comedy, right? And I didn't know that was what that was, but I loved watching that with my parents. And then I got a little older, went to college, and it wasn't until after college where I took like a theater class at a community college and like, you know, did theater, did a show and realized, oh, this exists in like America too. And that's when I discovered like how much I loved it. And then from then on, I think I was 24 at the time. I like did theater nonstop until 30, until I moved to LA.
Shit, that makes sense. What motivated you to go and take that first theater class?
Oh, so I graduated college and I was trying to get into medical school. I was trying to get into medical school. I didn't have the grades, so I went and did, the post-bac, took some more classes, try to get my grades up, try to take some of the classes I missed in college. And I finished, and now like I'm applying to medical school, and I saw that there's theater classes at the community college that had a good theater program. So I just thought, oh, screw it, I'll take a class. So I took a theater 1A, I took piano 1A, and I took a singing beginners class.
Oh.
And it's kind of snowballed from there.
When you say like you finished all the requirements, like OChem and physics and MCAT, like you got that all the way,
I did all of it.
man, that's an uphill battle to get all that out of the way. And did you end up applying?
I ended up applying. I didn't get in.
Damn, how did that feel?
I mean, it feels shitty, because I spent a lot of time trying to like get the grades up. I thought that's what I was supposed to be doing. I think it was like a good year and a half, just trying to like take classes, trying to grind, got a job as an EMT to like boost my
Yeah.
application status, like, oh, I do medical, look at me. But yeah, no, it wasn't, pretty shitty. I think it was after that. It was after I realized I didn't get in where I was like, oh man, like if this was all for nothing, I might as well just go do something I want to do. And then that's when I took the theater classes.
Right. And then when you were going through all that, were you doing that for yourself, or would you think you were doing that under your sort of like your parents' kind of wishes and dreams?
I don't know what I was doing it for, man. They never specifically pushed me into that, but they like, there was always pressure to do something great. And I have three sisters, and they're all very successful in their own rights. They're all always academically successful, and like they always had good jobs. And I always felt very insecure about that. So I thought, man, if I could just become a doctor, like everything would just fall into place. Like, they'll like look at me like, oh yeah, look, he could do it too, I think it got worse when I got to college and I met some of these guys who I thought like I became really good friends with, and they were all, one was going to be a one became a physical therapist, another guy became a dentist, another guy became a lawyer, and we were really good friends, and they were all like these high achievers, and I thought, oh man, you guys are doing it, I'm doing it too. Like, what else is there to do here? So I wouldn't say it was necessarily for me. It was just, like I saw the people around me doing what they were doing, and I thought, oh man, I got to keep up somehow.
God damn. But before we get into like the career, the work that you're doing now, I want to kind of explore that a little bit more. This idea of like we take these paths and these routes in life and we go down one avenue and it doesn't work out and other things start to kind of like develop. Looking back on that, was there any signs of like maybe you could have started a little earlier with the theater, the piano, the singing? Was it in you, the seeds in you?
It's hard to say. I want to say it always has been because, family gatherings and like things that I knew I kind of wanted to try out, but I was too scared to. Like I joined choir in middle school. Like I wanted to perform. I knew I wanted to perform. I just didn't think that like it was like an insecurity. Like, oh, to perform? What? That's weird. Like, no, I don't really know anyone who's doing it. Do I want to do it? No, you got to focus. You gotta take like the electives, you gotta do the sports, like that's what's gonna take to get into college.
Yeah.
You need to take Spanish to get into college. You can't be taking theater. Like no one goes to, like I've no one around me was doing it. She's like, well, if no one's doing it, then like I shouldn't be doing it. That's weird.
I know young kids in high school listen to the podcast because sometimes it's been required viewing from some of the high schools that I've been giving talks at, and they probably know of you. And to hear the journey of somebody who is kind of wandered through life in the early, in your 20s, and then stumble upon what you're meant to do. I hope that some kids can just have the courage after hearing about your life and other artists that come on the podcast that they should be exploring these themes a lot earlier for themselves and going for what they don't know exists out there.
Yeah. It's hard though, because if you grew up like me, right? and nobody around you was doing it, and your parents weren't talking about it, and nobody I knew was talking about it. It's hard to know that it's there,
Yeah.
you know? You have to stay curious. I was so like, I had this like weird tunnel vision where I just like, okay, this is what they're telling me to do. This is all that matters to like, get a good job, get a good family, go to college. Going to college was big for my parents. They wanted every single one of their kids to go to UC. And to their credit, they put every single one of us
Who used
into
to?
UC college with minimal debt. And they were like immigrants. They ran like clothing shops and like restaurants, and they got it done. So if it felt there's I don't know, I think there's this weird thing with immigrant kids where we're just like, man, they sacrificed a lot for us. Like let's not let's stay the course. Let's not get too out of line, right? We don't have time for this,
Yeah,
There's
I
a lot of
think.
that. But yeah, for sure, man. Like these kids, like if you can, like do explore, take a class, You think you don't have time, but I mean, I started the social media thing at 30 years old.
That's crazy. That's so
So 30
crazy.
years old.
So, were you still an EMT at the time when you started?
When I started,
The content creating.
oh yeah. I worked as an EMT since I think I went since I was 22. Maybe even before that, I took the EMT course the summer before senior year of college. So yeah, I moved down to UC, I moved down to LA, and I was still an ER technician, EMT, worked during COVID. And that was kind of what like spurred the videos. Made a bunch of videos about COVID and what was going on in the hospital.
So you were an EMT for that's like many years, right?
Yeah, oh yeah. I was an EMT for 10 years, 2 years
Oh,
on an
shit.
ambulance. And 8 years in the hospital.
Wow. And what gave you the impetus to create these videos?
I needed a creative outlet. Like that was the biggest thing. Because the reason I moved down to LA was to pursue an acting career.
Wow.
I was in the Bay Area working as an EMT, and I was auditioning for commercials. I was doing theater year round. After I took that theater class, like I was like, oh my God, I have to sign up for the conservatory. So I ended up getting associates in theater while working full time as an EMT. That took like 2 years while doing like theater shows at night. Like I didn't sleep at all. Like if you're young, if you're in your early 20s, mid 20s even, dude, fuck sleep, man. Like I know people say you need sleep, but like you need sleep later. Like if you're in your 20s, yo, just fucking grind. And I would work all night, 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. I would sleep. I would drive to the college, sleep in my car for 3 hours, have classes from 10 to like 4, take another nap, and have like the shows and rehearsals from 7 to 10. And it was just like that for a while, and I loved it.
See, if people land on your IG or your TikTok pages and they just see the content, they just see that there's this funny guy and he's giving just great insight on that EMT world and switching up on. But to sit here now in the last 5 minutes to hear what it takes to even get to that point to create, there is a lot of discipline that was instilled in you for those years to even get to the point where you did years in EMT and then start making the videos. So by the time you get to making videos, the consistency of living and your administrative sort of like skills is like at another level. So by the time you get to the video side of it, it's just now
Oh yeah.
acting. It's all of that coming together so
Yeah.
tightly.
It was definitely an accumulation of all those years, for sure.
And it shows in what you do, man. It really, really does. It yeah, when I saw it, when I and then when I saw the Embarrassed by Night performance, damn, I'm not gonna say this is between you and me because it's pretty public, but how I felt was you were the best, you're one of the best guys on that stage.
Yes.
The delivery, your delivery and everything is just so perfect, like the timing and all of that was just like I was very impressed. I was like, and I came home and I told a few of my friends because they're like kind of cringy thinking that it's all Vietnamese comedians. And they were like, it can't be that good, right? I was like, no. These fuckers were, no, these guys are lit. They're bringing it.
Dude, I love that show, man. And like, it's such a different feel to have like all, like not all, but like a lot of Vietnamese comedians. And like, you know, Vietnamese comedians I respect, man. I love those guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the stand-up comedy, I love it. I love it so much. And it comes from like those years of doing theater, on being on stage. I needed it again. And when the pandemic happened, it's like, oh my God, I need to get back to like doing theater with people. But it, you know, it didn't, they didn't allow it. So the easiest way to get back on stage was to do stand-up comedy.
Wow.
And that's what I did.
What did your parents, what have you, they been thinking of your journey so far?
Oh man, you know, it's all no, don't do it until the checks start coming in. And once they see the checks, they're like, oh, do more. You should do more. And now I'm getting advice, bro. Now I'm getting advice from my parents being like, oh, you know what's a good video idea? And I'm like, where's this coming from? What are you?
But they weren't like majorly putting pressure on you to keep doing the medical route, did they?
Oh yeah, it was my dad, not so much, but my mom for sure. My dad was always just kind of like floating in the background. But my mom for sure was just like, you know, Steven, if you come back to the Bay Area, because she works for the government. She was like, come back now, we'll get you a job at the hospital, you get you a nice pension, you work here for the next 10, 20 years, you retire, it's a good life. She did not want me to leave the hospital. She did not want me to leave the Bay Area. She thought it was pretty crazy. But yeah, there was a lot of pressure from her to go back to school, get that nursing degree, you know, stay at the hospital. Because like for her, she's worked for the government for like 15 plus years. And I see her pension. It's great. Like if she retires right now, she's making more money than like just off the retirement. I'm like, this is insane. Like, how is this possible? She's like, yeah, it works. You should do it. But I was like, Mom, you're 15 years in. I can't. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And there's so many kids of our generation, or my generation, who had to really put their dreams completely out of the picture. And do the things that they don't want to do because of the safety, because of the survival idea.
Yeah, man. And it's all about that for them. Cause like you can't blame your parents for that stuff. You know, like they don't know any better. Like they just want the best for you. And like, the only thing they know is this is the best way to do it. Right. They don't know any better. This is the best way to do it. Like, look, I laid off the foundation for you. You should just do the same thing. And we have a good life. Just do it. Right. And who can blame them for that? You know, but like, you really gotta be understanding. Don't fight them. Just like, I really tried not to blame her for anything. I like anytime, like I used to get mad at her, but like eventually I was like, I can't get mad at her. She can't see what I see.
Yeah.
She doesn't know. I have to show her. And, you know, eventually as I did, she was like, okay, I get it now. She's still my mom. She still worries. She's still like, hey, you know, if you're ever sad or it doesn't work out anymore, just come home. Like, you know, just come home, just get a nice job here. You can live with me. I'll split the house. I'll live here too. I'm like, I'm fine, Mom.
I have a feeling you're gonna have your own show if you want to. And I have a feeling you'll have your own, you know, your Ronnie Chang moment. You'd have your, you know, all of these things that the mainstream Asian guys are having right now. It's coming.
Oh, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed, man. We're working on it this year. Feels good.
It's the hard work and the consistency in showing up for all these things. You know, the opportunities open up when you really just grind and keep going. And it takes years.
Yeah, no, it takes years. And all that discipline just came from like, because being an actor in LA, anywhere, it's just like, oh, it's just so tedious. And it's every day, it's grinding, it's like mentally taxing. And there's like really no money in it unless you're in like that top, you know, 10, whatever percentage. I moved down to LA. I was living in a living room for like 2 years, man. I didn't have any money.
Fuck. So inspiring, you know, so inspiring to hear that.
Yeah, man, it's a grind, but you know, like once you hit that stride, man, like it's all worth it. No payoff.
Now, when in your TikTok and Instagram videos, did you feel like, holy shit, I'm getting traction?
It was right after. It only took like one or two of those tips from the ER TikTok videos. Yeah, it happened. It happened almost right away. I mean, I was making silly videos on social media before, but it was like nothing. It was like, regular like little Vine videos, little funny trends. But as soon as I put those, the scrubs on and did the first tips from the ER, it kind of just took off. And I was like, oh, like this is I just gotta keep doing this. And I did a tips from the ER like, every single day for a
Good.
month, anytime I could. Right. And then it just snowballed.
And how often do you do that now?
I try to post every day across social medias. I backed off from the tips from the ER just because I don't work in the ER anymore. And it feels almost like it's so silly. I felt like initially I was like, oh, I don't work there anymore. Like, should I still be talking about it? But then someone was like, dude, you've worked 10 years there. Like, there's
Yeah,
plenty to talk about. I'm like, yeah, you're right. I just
exactly.
don't do it as much anymore. There's like other content that I post now. But
Yeah.
yeah, it's every day. It's still every day.
Wow, man. And for anybody who's posting content and doing this work, it's not easy to even keep a month up of doing that.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how to do it. I have a small team now, so that helps, but
Yeah.
yeah.
And how do you prepare for each video?
Don't know. Just, I got a list of ideas. I used to, and I still sometimes I do this a lot too. I wake up and I write and I'll film just whatever I'm thinking of, which, I did for nearly a year and a half, but it got a little inefficient. So now we're starting to plan a little bit more. We're using like programs like Trello. My sister actually was in tech as like a marketing manager, and she left her job to help me. So she's been really like helping me organize my life and getting like helping me come up and with the video ideas and helping me, with my emails. So yeah, man, it's just, I just wake up, I write, and I do it.
God, that's such a blessing to have a sister, be involved with your life. I mean, who else is going to watch you and care for you as much as a sister?
Yeah, no, I know. I felt really good about it. But at the same time, it's like, okay, Steven's blowing up. Like, I'm gonna quit my job. I'm like, me too. I want to come. Like, all right, are you sure you want? You sure? I guess.
Yeah, that I mean, I'm sure she's probably having a great time.
Yeah, no, she's loving it.
Yeah. Now, when you are doing all of these EMT videos and creating that content on social media, were you already doing stand-up comedian work?
Oh man, you know what? I took a stand-up comedy class near the end of 2019, right before everything shut down, and then comedy just ended. So I did comedy for maybe like 3 or 4 months, right before COVID happened. COVID shut it down, and then the videos happened. So not too long. Just, I just dabbled in it, and then everything shut down. And when everything opened back up, I had this huge following. But I had like maybe 8 minutes of material, if that. Like,
Yeah.
I was new. I had like nothing, right? But like, I was like, oh my God, like, I'm gonna go do this show at my friend's place. And bro, the line was out the
Oh,
freaking
shit.
door for this tiny. I didn't like, I was like, oh shit, like, you guys are here to see. Like, I had nothing to say. We filled up that entire space, and I got up there. I was just like, hi, everybody. And it scared the crap out of me. I was like, oh, I can't do this. I can't just have people pay like 20, $25 for a ticket and have nothing to say.
Got 8 minutes.
But kept at it. Yeah, no, I have like if that, I have, it maybe 8 minutes, It was like, half of it was like dick jokes because that's what every comedian starts off
Yeah.
doing.
Man,
So it was like,
how fortunate you are to have that fan base going into stand up, because that's everybody's goal, right? Is to be able to make sure that you put butts in the seats as a comedian. I mean, that's the name of the game.
yeah.
If you Yeah, and then to come out of the gate it's like the reverse problem. It's like you have all the fans, but you have no material.
Yeah, man. Yeah, and it's been a great problem to have recently. Like, I recently did my first like 45-minute set, and it's just like, bro, like, there's people here. I did 45 minutes, but it was a terrible set, and it's like, oh, man, I really got to figure this out. Because we have the audience. We don't have the show. I gotta put the fucking show together.
How do you know you were bombing?
I know some comedians who are just so out of touch with reality that they refuse to believe they're ever bombing. And it's like, okay, dude, come on. Like,
Yeah.
let's be real. But like I know I have a strong sense of when I'm bombing because I feel like I know what it feels like to have a really good show. Like I know what that feels like. And it's so like if it's not that and it's like far all the way to the other
Yeah.
opposite side of that, then yeah, like that's what it felt like bombing.
But in order to get like a good show, you probably need to be on the road in random cities, random stand-up places to do maybe a year or two to get that rhythm, to get the content, to get all of the material sort of worked out in about a year or two. You don't have that luxury because you have people waiting to go to the show, but you don't have. So how do you work around pumping in this material in a short amount of time?
I have no idea, man. I'm figuring it out right now. Like, I have a tour set up for this year. I'm going with my buddy Jack Jr., and we're like co-headlining shows. So, like, I've done 45 minutes a few times now. It only felt decent once. So, and I asked other like comedians. I've asked like comedians who have done it for a while. Like, dude, because here's the thing. When you're going on the road and for an actual show, there's a host, a feature, and a headliner, right? The host would do 10 minutes and he'll like bring up the feature and the headliner. The feature would do typically 20 to 25 minutes, and the headliner would do 45 to an hour. Like I felt like I got the 20, 25 minutes down. I ask everybody, dude, how did you jump from 25 to 40? And they're just like, you just gotta do it. There's really no in between 25, between feature and headliner. You
Wow.
just have to like try the 45 and you get it right.
Fuck.
So
Because I can
that's where we're
imagine
at
like
right now.
a month, every month, if you're like out on the road, you pick up a good 3 to 5 minutes, right? Like if you're out there and you're just writing new material and you're testing shit out.
Yeah, man, maybe, hopefully. Like I know comedians who have been doing it for years and who have finally got like a solid 4 to 5 minute set, who finally get the opportunity to go like headline, if that. So, it just
Shit.
depends. It just
That is a
depends.
lot of fucking pressure, man.
Yeah, but it's good. It's a good problem to have, like I said.
What's your process to write these bits?
It's a process. I mean, usually, like I have like the notepad on my cell phone.
Yeah.
I write down anything that just comes to my mind, and I'll try to write down something before I test it out. Like I used to go to a lot of open mics in LA.
Yeah.
Where you pay $5, you get up there. There's like 10 other comedians who also paid $5 who don't give a crap about what you're saying. Most of them are on their phone. So you just go up there, you try, you say it out loud. If you can get like a ha-ha, a chuckle, like, okay, this might work in front of a 20-person audience,
Yeah.
And then from there, you go like, you go do your show, you go to your 10, 15-minute spot, you do 10 minutes of like the good stuff, and then 5 minutes, maybe you mess around with like a and hopefully it works. And then maybe you work it and rework it. And hopefully by the end of it, you get a good 2, 3 minute bit out of that 15 minute bit that you started with.
Yeah, wow. It's such a huge work, a massive effort to really get these small, minutes to add up into a full show.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I love it though. I love it.
And what about acting? Are you going out for you auditioning for acting roles?
No, I had an acting agent when I got to LA. I had to drop them when the social media thing was really blowing up because I got so busy and I haven't gotten back to it since.
Isn't that ironic? You start out with one thing and your love of one thing, but something else takes off and it's just like it totally derails your plans and
Yeah, man. And I talked to a lot of my friends who are in the social media, like who are, somewhere like where I'm at my level, and they're like, yeah, like why would we go back to auditioning for movie jobs? We got this is almost better. We have so
yeah.
much more freedom, we get paid more. It's hard to like, it's hard to be in this social media place where it's like it feels like the golden era of social media. It's hard to be in this place where you're so successful and then going back to having to like answer to like casting directors and be on set for like 12 hours at a time just for like, you know, a couple of minutes in front of the camera. It's a lot. Being an actor is hard. Being an actor is very hard for those of you who are trying it.
Yeah, but all those skills that you pick up as an actor and the training, it shows. It shows on the quality of the delivery of what you do with your videos.
Yeah, man. I hope so. That's good to know.
It's not an accident, right? Because there's a lot of people that try to put these videos together, put the content together, but it doesn't materialize in a way that they think it materializes. It doesn't bring in the views. And a lot of that has to do, I'm pretty sure, with the amount of training that you do.
I think so too. But then again, but like, you know, again, I'm the same way. When I started this TikTok thing, I was looking at people doing like these dances or just like these whatever they were doing. I'm like, hey, this can't be that hard. I'm looking into like, what is this? And then I tried it. I'm like, okay, yeah, it takes a lot more. It takes a lot more effort than what it looks like. But you know what I mean? Like people looking in, it's just like, oh, you're just eating in front of a camera. I'm like, I could do that. There's so much FOMO when it comes to the social media stuff. Everyone's just like, oh shit, they could do it. Like, I could do this. I'll try it too.
Okay, let me ask you then, what do you think the magic is? What do you think that thing is?
You know, lately, what the magic is for social media and TikTok, it's just like being like this authenticity. Like, so much of what I'm seeing on TikTok and social media now is like people talking directly to the camera and just being like, this is me. Get ready with me while I go do this. This is my life. Okay, let me tell you the story while I like cut a fruit. Let me tell you the story about my life while I put on makeup. You know, it's a lot of that. Or like podcasting. That's why I think like that's why podcasting is so interesting. Like I'm just going through social media. I'm like watching people talk, just podcasting. It's just like because they're having a conversation, right? It's not too glammed up.
But that's why so many of these comedians are killing it in the podcast game.
Yeah, man. Yes.
Yeah. Are you ever gonna
Are.
get you you gotta get into it, right?
Oh God. You know, I thought about it. It's just another thing to do. And I don't
Yeah.
know if I'm ready for it yet. But I'm thinking about it, but I don't
Well, we need you. We need you out there. We need you out
know.
there in the podcast game. There's not a lot of Vietnamese people doing it.
Yeah. That's the thing too. Like if I do it, like I don't know what I'd be talking about. Is it talking about Would we be talking about being Vietnamese? Is it talking about the ER, the medical stuff? What type of guests am I having on? You know, I thought about it. Just like, is it going to be like a tips from the ER podcast? Or would it be like, you know, comedians, Vietnamese comedians? I don't know.
Yeah, but you could go anywhere. You could go everywhere because I think in the beginning, when you sort of like start with the podcast, it can be about ER and bringing ER stories and all that. And then you slowly open it up, right? You slowly open it up to more broad, general, relationships and all kinds of shit like Tiger Belly. It's like now it's just about fucking anything. But, I think starting out with the ER stories, because that's a very interesting topic too, what goes on in the ER and all that, which is actually, I have several questions about that today. I really do want to ask about the life and death aspect and how close you get to people dying on the job.
Oh yeah, I mean, shoot, it's the ER, you know, happens all the time. I think on average, if I work 3 12-hour shifts a week, at least one person, I'll be involved with at least one person's death. We're doing CPR. Sometimes, but sometimes like because like it's the emergency room, so we take care of patients, and we try to stable them, keep them stable, so they go to like the OR, or they go to the ICU, or they go to other units, right? The emergency room is like, make sure they don't die and then get them somewhere else. So I don't always necessarily see what all ends up happening. Sometimes we'll call up and be like, hey, remember that guy that was sent to OR yesterday that was in an accident? Did he make it? And they'll be like, yes or no. So like I'll find out the next day. But, at least once a week, there will be, especially where I worked at in the Bay Area, there will be, a trauma that comes in where the guy just doesn't make it.
And is there any time where I know this is like fucking glamorizing from movies and shit, but somebody reaches like out to your hand and they like give you their last words and be like, yo, I'm gonna die. And I just, can you tell this to my family or anything like that?
No, I have not had that happen. Because usually in the ER, it's because I mean that's more of like people who are like might. That sounds peaceful, right? In the ER, if someone's like dying, dude, they're not supposed to die. We're doing everything we can to freaking keep them alive, which means like we're sticking tubes into every part of their body. We're doing CPR. We're like trying to stop the bleeding. It's controlled chaos. It's never like,
Yeah.
oh, it's never too quiet, right?
And has any of them ever affected you, like a kid, or if somebody affected you and you just brought that shit home and you just really affected you for a few days?
Oh man. Yeah. Oh yeah. There was a couple that there was a couple. I mean, one in particular was it was the 4th of July, man. And 4th of July, it happens like clockwork every year. Somebody gets their freaking hand blown off from a firework, right? And one year, this freaking kid comes in. It was his mom, dad. He was 12, and his younger brother was like 8 years old, right? And they brought the 12-year-old in. Because they were at the beach and he picked up a stray fryer cracker off the beach and it blew up in his hand and his hand was gone, bro. His hand was gone. And we're in there like trying to like console his parents and we're all pretty sad about it because he's 12. And you look at the kid and guess what he's doing, man? He's consoling his 8-year-old brother, being like, "It's okay. We'll still be able to play football. I'll just use my other hand." And I'm just like, dude, how is this happening right now? Like
And they
that was like
couldn't,
I
they
that struck a
couldn't.
nerve. And I don't know how long it stayed with me because we rarely do this thing where we like, okay, let's acknowledge that this happened, right? It was one time where we like I remember one time where like one nurse was like, "No, we have to stop. Everybody into the break room. We have to like think about what happened and how does everyone feel?" And that was the one time out of like my 10 years where like we debriefed, but every other time it was just like, go, 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 go. This is happening. It's okay. On to the next patient. It's always busy too, Don't really have time to like debrief and talk about it.
Yeah, man, fucking, you're dealing with death like weekly for 10 years. But
Yeah.
you have such a light attitude about you. You have such this really light quality about the way you carry yourself,
Oh man, you have to when you work there. If you
Yeah.
take, if you take the, if you take, if I took all that seriously and I brought it all around with me, like there's no way I feel like I'd be so, I don't know, I'd feel so shitty about it. You try not to take it seriously. That's why, hopefully it translates to the ER videos. Like, yeah, it sucks, but like at the same time, you kind of gotta laugh because if you don't, you keep it all right here and you just fucking crumble.
Yeah, but I think you approach it from some, like a kind of, well, not like the kid blowing his hand off, but more of the absurdity of, the meth, side of things, or, just commonsensical comedy that comes from, people not thinking too critically about how they ended up there.
Yeah, man, that all happens too. It all happens too. We just sit there, and just cope. Me and my coworkers are just like, "Can you believe this shit's happening?" I can't believe this shit's happening. What?
And, in the process of as you're going along, right, in these next few years, where do you eventually really want to land? Is it more in the acting arena? Is it, more stand up? Is it more, in the writing, being on a big show like the Tonight Show? Like, what is your ultimate dream?
Oh man, it's a good question. Right now we're just trying to do as much as possible. I would love to be known as a stand-up comedian.
Wow. Okay.
I would love to be known as like not just another TikToker who's trying to like take advantage of his fans. to bring them out to a show. I would love to be respected as a comedian, you know. And then from there, like, I would love, you know, I would love to do a sitcom. You know, like, a lot of my inspiration for acting came from these family sitcoms like George Lopez, Ray Romano, the King of Queens guy, you know, Friends, like live four cam sitcoms, which almost feels like theater in a way.
Yeah.
And when I was trying to figure out, oh, how do I get there? It was like, oh, a lot of these guys started off as comedians, you know? So hopefully somewhere in that realm where I can be a comedian, but also eventually make my way onto TV, known as a comedian who can deliver lines, just, you know, deliver lines in a very funny way, right? Even do like a game show like Steve Harvey for Family Feud. I think
Yeah.
that would be so much fun.
It's hard to kind of remember sometimes that Kevin Hart, right? Like, you know, if you're like just a kid growing up now and you kind of see what he's doing and you don't realize like that was like a comedian who grinded for a very, very long time for him to get where
Oh
he
yeah, man.
got. And he probably outworked everybody like Kobe, right?
Oh yeah. He's got a couple books out. I'd recommend you guys read it. Kevin Hart had like a crazy, I think he like did it all in Philadelphia, where he would like drive every night. It was like maybe an hour or 2 hours to get to New York to do the spots and come back. You know, he was grinding for a while, and he was like dead broke for a while. You know, he had like kids early, you know. But yeah, man, he's someone, he's an inspiration. You see what he has now. He's like at the top of the game, but you know, he wasn't always like that for sure.
I gotta check out that memoir. I mean, I've read so many, you know, Viola Davis, you know, Taraji Henson, Will Smith, you know.
Yeah, Viola Davis had a good one. I listened to her audiobook just
Yeah, me
because like
too.
she's an incredible like storyteller. Dude, I loved her
No,
story and the way that
dude,
she told it.
Viola Davis's memoir is just, you know, you're just like peeing in her pants up to like 8 years old or 9 years. I was just
Yeah.
speechless. I mean, I'm like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? I haven't done
She
shit.
went through some she went through some trauma.
Drama.
Don't you
Dude,
think? She went
Steven,
through
I'm
some
so
crazy
happy that
trauma.
like we're connecting on this memoir stuff because it's like if we don't read that stuff, we think that we're like grinding, but we're not really doing shit compared to like what they've gone through, you know? These people who have like gone way, I mean, yeah, you
Yeah.
actually grind a lot, but you know, but when you look back on like the
No,
violent.
nothing. Nothing like that. It's something about that, like, dude, something about Black women and like their upbringing. Like, I also listened to Tiffany Haddish's,
Yeah.
and like the crap that she went through because she was a foster kid for a majority of her childhood, man. And like
Wow.
some of her stories were just so like, oh my God! Like she was in a home one day where like this old man in a wheelchair found her like stuffing tissues into her bra because she was like, I want to make my, you know, I want to grow my boobs because I'm jealous of the other girls. And the dude's like, I know what to do. Just come to me every morning. I'll suck on them. They'll grow. And she did. Like, she went through this. And I was like, how the hell
God.
do people go through this and just like come out on top like that? Dude, like, the respect I have for Black women
Yeah, me too. I'm the same way.
growing up in this country, I'm just like, dude, this is insane.
Yeah.
Viola Davis. She had some crazy shit that happened to her.
Crazy ass shit. I mean, it's very different from Michelle Obama's memoir too. You know,
I
Michelle
didn't
Obama.
get to that one.
Yeah, hers is, you know, really grateful for her family because her mom, dad, grandparents, and really everybody around her ecosystem allowed her to flourish. But it's not like Viola Davis or, you know, Taraji, you know, Henson or Tiffany Haddish.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
Will Smith's one was pretty crazy too.
Oh, I didn't read Will Smith's one.
Yeah.
What did he didn't have a cushy childhood?
He did not have a cushy childhood. He had a very tough father. But
Oh,
you see
really?
how the tough father really. You know, the dad made them build like this brick wall in the backyard for a whole year, brick by brick, laying and stirring up concrete and then pouring, you know, mixing concrete so they can make a wall. It rain or shine, like a whole year. And he keeps bringing it up in the whole book, like everything is brick by brick, right? So that's what gave him the sort of the tenacity to really, and now that I'm listening to your life, I could see the parallels of the tenacity, right? A decade in the ER and being so close and witnessing death and living and all of the hardships and sort of like, you know, life goes on, you know, life goes on.
Yeah, man.
You know who else had a fucking crazy one? Is Trevor Noah.
Oh,
Born a Crime.
As well, it's been a while. I can't remember it. Like, I feel like I did. I read that one.
3 years.
Dude, he's one of my favorite comedians. He's one of my favorite comedians, man. Like off air, like, do you ever watch like those little scenes where he's like at the Daily Show, but they cut because they got to do some stuff around break, and he just talks to the audience. Yeah, yeah. Those are my favorite clips where he's just being himself and talking to the audience. I fucking love those clips. He's one of my, he's like, he talks, you listen, you know?
Yeah, he's smart, guys. Super smart. But his, Born a Crime was what, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in New York a few months ago, and we, you know, one of my boys got tickets to go to backstage and to go to the Daily Show, and we were in the audience, and we went to a taping, and he was talking about like all the places, you know, he's going to go when he stops doing the Daily Show and everything like that, and he had mentioned that he wanted to go to Vietnam and everything like that, and then he turned to the crowd during the time that the cameras were off. He turns to the crowd, he's like, so where do you think I should go? And I yelled out, Vietnam. And then he goes, yo, I just told you I'm going to Vietnam. He's like, he called me out, man. It was like the most embarrassing shit.
That's great.
Oh, yeah. It's so embarrassing.
Go to Vietnam, Trevor.
Have you been?
Oh, yeah. I used to go all the time.
Wait, before we get into Vietnam, though, what other memoirs has changed your life or give you more insight?
Man, I used
to. I'm so impressed that you've read, like, you know, Viola Davis's and, you know, Born a Crime and all this.
I listened to hers, man. That was, I fucking loved it. Who else have I read? I used to read a lot. I really got into like a lot of the comedians.
Yeah.
I've read Kevin Hart's.
I got to do Kevin Hart's now.
I think I started Amy Poehler's when I was in New York, but I didn't finish it. Oh, there was a lot. I've read so many of them. I listened to Tom Segura's on Audible.
But you know, maybe this is a reverse prejudice for me, but I don't find white comedians' autobiographies or memoirs as interesting as black comedians for some reason.
I mean, yeah, probably. I mean, you know, for reasons. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the reason is. I don't think Tom Segura's white. I'm pretty sure he's Mexican.
Oh shit!
Yeah.
Unless it's Bill Burr. I mean, Bill Burr is like fucking, he's just fucking just.
Yeah, Bill Burr had a pretty traumatic childhood too. I think his dad really fucked him up.
Yeah. And how would you get to the next level if you're not reading these memoirs and these autobiographies of these, you know, people that you emulate, right?
Yeah. No, like that was the whole reason. I'm like, dude, like if I could just learn from these guys, like how do I get to them? Like they won't talk to me. So I said, screw it. So I'll just try to read their stories through their books. And I've been listening to Kevin Hart has a podcast now called Comedy Goldmines, where he talks to, like, you know, the biggest comedians, and he just goes down to, like, you know, tell me how it started, tell me what happened. And listening to that podcast has been really helpful. Yeah, and just learning about like what they went through, how long they had to grind for. Ali Wong's was incredible too.
Oh shit. I have hers on my queue. Like that's
because
one of them.
She was grinding for like 10 years before that first special came out. And out of nowhere, she just blew the F up. But she was grinding for a long time, man. Long, long time.
All right. Those are the next ones. The Ali Wong one, the Kevin Hart one.
You gotta, I mean, you know, Vietnamese. You gotta listen to the Ali Wong one.
Yeah. You know, for all the kids out there listening, you know, it takes more than just doing the work of just, you know, like for you, it just takes more than just writing. It just takes more than just showing up. It's now you got to like be constantly bombarded with the inner circle stories that these people are putting out. And it's out there for us to consume. It's out there for us to learn from. I mean, and if we're not learning about this stuff, then there's no way. Like, you know, Chappelle, you know, starting out so young on the comedy circuit, knowing that these people put years and years and years, and then they're just not doing the circuit, but they're doing the work that is required way beyond you know, any kind of, in order to be the best, like a Kobe, you have to be doing the work and you have to be doing the cross training and other shit that's out available for you.
Oh yeah, man. Yeah, you gotta be multi-talented, whatever that is. You gotta be like a triple, quadruple threat. You gotta do it all these days.
Yeah. Now, going to Vietnam, you know, what's your thoughts on all that?
Like now or when I went
when we
when I
was when you went when you went back the first few times?
Oh man. You know, it's good. Like I was so appreciative of my parents taking me there when I was at that age, because like it was a culture shock. Because when I went, I forgot what year it was, but it wasn't like what it is now. It's
Yeah.
pretty touristy now. You know, they got like, I think they got like in Saigon, there's like a Stark Tower, which is like a hotel. It's like an exact replica of the Tony Stark Tower in the Iron Man movie. I mean, when I went, like,
Raw.
I think what really broke me was when I got there and I saw these beggars on the streets without legs, and they were using like this step stool,
Yeah,
in one hand to carry their body and a hand another to like push them, and then they were asking not for money but to buy a lotto ticket,
yeah.
And I was like I felt like I that's what I like I felt like a change in my body, and I was very young when I saw that. I'm like, shit, people live like this, you know. And also, it also, you know what it also taught me when I got there, that like some of these people who are like begging for money or buying lotto tickets, we would be sitting in a restaurant eating, and they would come into the restaurant not knowing anybody and just like, hey, do you want to buy a ticket while we're eating? And it's like, oh, eating's kind of rude. Like, is the store owner gonna say anything about this guy? No, they don't say nothing. Yeah, okay? Buy a ticket? No, fine. And he sits at a table, doesn't order anything. I'm like, can you imagine if that happened in America, where like you're in an established restaurant and like some beggar came in and like was asking them for you to buy a lotto ticket? You get shooed out of there, right? Yeah. But I think it comes down to like, oh, like these are my people. You know, there's no racism here.
Right.
Like, I'm not trying to like kick them out. Like I feel for them. Like this is, you know, my family. Just come in, you know, do what you have to, make some money if you can. If not, chill and then go.
Yeah.
You're not hurting anybody.
But I think it's like that nature of a homogeneous society where everybody looks the same, everybody's sort of speaks the same language, and there's no alienation, right? Everybody's like, oh, okay, well, they got their legs blown off in the war, or the remnants of a past, you know, war, and we're going to accept that, and it's fine. And I think there's this karmic value of, you know, Asian countries, where they're just like, okay, we accept that. But in America, it's a little bit harder because, you know, there are different socioeconomic forces at play that don't allow that to happen.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a
yeah, man. Being in Vietnam like at an early age, actually, it was great.
Yeah.
Taught me a lot.
Have you done any stand-up in Vietnam?
No, I haven't been back to Vietnam in years.
Yeah. Do you know Fred Lay? Yeah, of course you do. Fred Lay, Embarrassed by Night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he's told me about a few comedy clubs, stand-up comedy. There's a stand-up comedy scene now in Vietnam.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, you should talk to him about it next time, man, because that would be, you know, because it's in English. You know, they have stand-up comedy clubs in English.
Oh, shoot. That'd be awesome. Yeah, no, I just got off the phone with Andy like 2 days ago, right before the weekend, where I found us a decent venue to do the next Embarrassed by Night in Monterey Park.
Like, no,
we got a good place. They're giving us a good door deal. I think it's the right venue. Like, we should do it
in Monterey Park.
Yeah,
my backyard.
Is it?
Yeah, I live in Alhambra.
Yeah, yeah. It's at if it works out, it'll be at the Marriott in Monterey Park. They got like a nice little spot in there where they're like, yeah, if you want to do it here, we let you do it.
Dude, let me know, because I'll blow it up. I'll get all the friends to come out and check it out.
Right?
Yeah.
Like it would work. I told Andy, like, yo, man, like as soon as, because he was in SF for the games, the football games. So I was like, well, as soon as you get back, let's check out the space together. Let's make it happen. I love that nice. Show.
And then you guys are doing a show coming up, right? In the 28th of January?
I can't make it. They're going to San Jose. Yeah.
Yeah. Damn. And then when are they planning? When do you guys want to do the Monterey Park one?
I think we're trying to get it done by the March or April, if it works out.
Cool. I'm excited. I look forward to all the work that you brothers are putting out there, man. I love the whole idea of Embarrassed by Nine. I love what you're doing, Stephen. Thank you so much for, you know, coming on to the show today. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. It was fun. Always love talking about this stuff.
Very cool, man. We'll talk soon. And next time we'll talk about some more memoirs.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Ken.
All right, Stephen. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.